So I jumped on the train, and the last car was pulling out when I got to the station. And I looked, and there were only two people on it, me and another guy. The doors closed. He reaches in his pocket. He has a switchblade. He still, starts clicking the switchblade and looking at me. And I'm thinking, I'm tired. I don't want to have to shoot this guy. I decided at the time when you carried handkerchiefs, I got out of my handkerchief and got my gun out and started rubbing my gun down and looking at him. And then it stops at the next stop. Man, he couldn't get off that train.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the next episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. This is very special. I tell you what, today is so special that, we usually have small town police blotters on here. I'm foregoing that because the gentleman we have with us today, he's a friend of mine. I think you're going to be impressed with who I've got for you this week. And he has so many stories. I'm afraid we're going to run out of time to tell them all. So this gentleman is a former U.S. Army veteran. Take our hats off to him for there. 5.5 years in the military and 25 years as an FBI special agent. And I tell you what, and you will never hear me say this again, I'm in awe of this guy. I've worked with him before. We worked together for a couple of years on a different project after we both retired from government service. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a true American patriot that you're looking at. He's being very humble. He won't even look at me right now. I'm watching him on the camera. It's going to be like pulling teeth to get him to tell you some of what he did personally. He doesn't want to take credit for anything. And what do I say in my book? That's a hero. And heroes never want to take credit for anything that they did. They're just doing their jobs. But it is my true honor and pleasure to welcome my good friend, Dale Watson. Dale, welcome to Game of Crimes, brother.
Steve, glad to be here. You're a patriot as well, and thanks for the introduction. I try not to talk about myself very often for a lot of reasons, but we all worked hard and all our careers, and I know you did too. So, and things in life develop that you're in places where you're either lucky or unlucky to be, and then you do the best you can.
That's the truth.
I appreciate coming on, and I hope your listeners enjoy some of this conversation.
I'm sure they will. I can't wait. And now that we've got this bromance thing out of the way, we can actually get down to details. And I got to tell you how Dale and I met. We were both in retirement. A good friend of mine who's a retired DEA special agent charge, Mike Marsak, called me about a contract that a company called Booz Allen had. And Booz Allen is one of the, they refer to them in Washington as the Beltway Bandit companies that do a lot of government contracts and things like that. And he said, based on your experience, this involves the U.S. Navy's Dev Group, which was formerly called SEAL Team 6. So for our regular listeners, if you remember, Javier and I worked with SEAL Team 6 as well as the U.S. Army's Delta Force. They were with us in Medellin for 18 months, so we had a little bit of history there. The requirements to get on that contract was you had to be a former senior executive service with your agency. I think that might have been the only requirement, and you were available. And you'd do it for next to nothing because Booz Allen didn't pay a whole lot, but it's money for easy work. So we had on the team, we had an FBI, former FBI SES, which was Dale. That's where we first met. I was there for DEA. We had a former CIA chief of station. We had a former U.S. ambassador. And then one of the guys was from DevGru was a retired senior master chief. That was pretty much our team. And I would like to say that it was classified, and I can't tell you about it, but that makes it sound ominous. And it really wasn't. I mean, we're not going to talk about what we talked to them about, but it was suffice it to say it was what to expect in an overseas environment when dealing with the U.S. Embassy. So you come in, and I don't know any of these people. I get there, and there's Dale, and as you're here, he talks a lot like me. He doesn't have a New York City accent, although he was stationed there for a while. We'll talk about that. But just he welcomed me in with open arms. He kind of, I guess he's picked up a little bit that I was nervous and kind of walked me through things and helped me get along. And we ended up just having a blast. I think that went on for, eventually I brought Javier in because I was getting busy on some other stuff. And so I would do one, then Javier would do it. But we all got to hang out with Dale and just great, great, great memory. So to bring Dale here on the show, he doesn't do these interviews. I'm not sure that he ever does interviews. And I had to pull out the friendship card. I had to put the guilt trip on him. And actually, when I asked him if he'd do it, he said yes. He said, for you, I'll do it. So And I'm going to give you a hard time, Dale, about some things. You know, our secrets will stay our secrets. If
Yeah, well, you got offended when you said you were with DEA, and I responded by saying, you know what that means, don't expect anything, or drunk every afternoon. So you
or don't even ask.
You didn't speak to me for about a week. Don't even ask. That's a good one. That's a new one. I learned from you. You told me those, really, seriously. So we laughed about it.
But yeah.
They were throwing stones at the FBI, and we were, I mean, it was just convenient. But we did a good job. They really needed help around how to maneuver in a overseas environment. Non-combat, so to speak. If they get to the embassy, that sort of stuff. So it was a lot of fun. One of my fond memories is that job.
It was. We had some good dinners. We had some good times. That was, and you know, and the thing I liked the most is some of those SEALs who come out and have dinner with us and get to telling stories, and it just ends up being a good evening, real good evening. So, and by the way, I won't say it here on the recording, but I probably told you what the FBI stands for too. And there's a couple there that I'm not going to say on here.
First Baptist Independent.
Okay.
Well, don't put this in there. Okay. All right. Good deal.
Yeah. So, right. And I'm going to start off with you, Dale, just like we do to everybody. Tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, what your family looks like, where you went to high school and college and that kind of thing, brother.
Sure. Real quick. I grew up in Central Florida between Orlando and Tampa, a rural county called Lake County. I'm the third of three sons. My father was a Baptist minister, and he also farmed. We had a farm that we all had to work on. I have two brothers, one retired general officer with Florida National Guard. He was the adjutant general there for a number of years, and another brother who was very successful in business and retired, worked for Ross Perot for years and retired. He lives out in Dallas. Oh. So high school, I went to school there. We moved around a little bit, but not very much. We settled down and I was able to continue from like the sixth grade on through a local high school, a small school, class president every year from the sixth grade on. I played high school football before you had to be really talented to make the team, and played basketball, believe it or not. I'm not that tall, but this way back when. And my life took a real, most people don't believe this story, but I was always, my goal after the eighth grade was to be an FBI agent, believe it or not. And
what was the impetus for that?
They had a career day. They come down to high school, had a career day or something in the eighth grade, ninth grade. Everybody, I think, went to it. And I went to it, and they had an agent that came down from one of the resident agencies outside the county in Marion County. Not that that really matters, but, and he spoke about it, and it sounded very interesting and intriguing. And I decided, well, that's what I want to do, believe it or not. And so I talked to him there in the eighth grade and says, you know, what's the requirements? And he said, well, you have to be a lawyer or an accountant to get in. And I said, well, I'm not interested in either one of those two career fields. So I went and graduated from high school. I got a scholarship to Florida State. I was up
for what?
Scholarship house, academics. So it was help people think this organization, Southern Research Foundation, gave out mainly for kids that probably couldn't afford. So I got a partial scholarship. I lived with a bunch of guys and I borrowed money through the, to go to school, mm-hmm. and stayed there, graduated from there, and
why Florida State? How'd you pick Florida State?
My other two brothers had gone there, and it was a mortal sin to be a University of Florida
Gator.
So I quickly became a Gator hater, and the Canes weren't too far behind for people that love football. So a little off track here, but. I still wanted to do this, even though I didn't take a criminology course when I was there. But another guy came by that was working at the local FBI office in Tallahassee. I didn't know anybody in the FBI. I didn't know anything about anything. And he comes by the scholarship house. And so he says, yeah, we're looking for people And I assumed it was accountant and lawyer. So I asked him afterwards, still it's accountant and lawyers? And this is back in the 70s. And he said, well, no, we've opened it up some. If you're a military officer or if you have military service, you can put in. Mm-hmm. And so I decided that, well, I didn't give this a shot. I'm going to get a degree here in government and have a fallback if I need to, that I'll be able to get a job, maybe as a school teacher, do something like that. And so I decided to go ahead and pursue that through ROTC there at Florida State. They had a good ROTC program. They had the Air Force and the Army. I selected the Army. My father was in the World War II in the Navy. My two brothers had been on in the military and the Army. Mm-hmm. So I selected that and I went through the program. And one of the big advantages was it paid me $50 a month from my junior year on to be in ROTC just during the school year. So I thought that was good. Came time to get ready to go out, and my class of ROTC students was like 128 or something. Then went to Fort Bragg for summer training during my junior, senior year. I did very well up there, very, very well. Came in like top 10 out of the brigade or what, or company, large company. Mm-hmm. So I get back, and all I want to do is sign up, go in, and do this thing. The Vietnam War was going on. And so it didn't matter. And then the adjutant, people in your life come along that do things that change your life. And the adjutant for the ROTC program there at FSU was a major, and he called me in. He said, Dell, he says, you did very well, and you need to apply for this regular Army commission. And I said, well, I'm going to be commissioned anyway. And he said, yeah, it's a reserve commission. And I said, well, what's the advantage of this? And he said, well, I don't want to get you too wound up here. It's through an act of Congress that they select certain people, and it's designed for people that want careers or promises anyway, that you could stay in 20 years, basically, unless you really screwed it up. And mm-hmm. I said, I'm really moving forward here. I want to just go in and do what I need to do. And he said, no, listen, one of the problems is that when you get a reserve commission, you have to wait 2 or 3 months to get a school at Fort Benning or whatever your branch was. So I was married at the time. So I decided, well, what's this RA deal? And they said, the day you graduate is the day you start getting paid and start your class. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, okay, let me try it. So I put in the paperwork, didn't hear anything. And then sure enough, there were 5 of us out of the class that were selected for that. So wow. I was selected for the infantry, and I went to Fort Benning and went to jump school there, airborne training, and started it, just made it, went on out and ran a infantry platoon for a while. The military, my career was controlled by the Department of Defense up in the Pentagon because of my status. And he called the captain managing my career and said, Lieutenant, we need to get you to Vietnam, and you need that experience. I said, well, I'm here. let's do it.
Nope.
I mean, no pushback here. And he said, I'll be in touch. And so he called me, and, you know, I've forgotten February, and said, I got bad news for you. There's a long waiting list. They were winding down and withdrawing at that time. So I stayed there for 5.5 years, or in the Army anyway. And one of the reasons was that the money that I borrowed from to go to school was a pretty good size debt. And the government had a plan that if you went in the military, they'd pay back 10% a year. And so I stayed for the 50% and then paid the rest off. So
nice.
I
nice.
Paid my
That's forward thinking.
Loans and everything. And then decided that it's time to do it. I applied to the FBI out in Fort Sill, as a matter of fact. And they said, yeah, we got your application. We're not taking anybody. So I had to stay another 6 months, basically, because they were not hiring at the time. And they asked me very pointedly, I'm dragging this out, maybe. They asked me pointedly, how much time do you need to get out of the Army? And I said, well, let me be clear about this one. I did. I said, I need probably at least 6 weeks because I have this RA thing. And they don't have to let me go. I would say I could be there next month, but that's not going to happen. So they said, okay, we'll give you plenty of time. And then about another month later, they called and said on Tuesday and said, you have a class that starts Monday. And I says, true story.
That sounds like DEA.
There's my lifelong dream to be an FBI agent, and they throw this at me. And I said, there's no way. I get arrested for AWOL. I can't do that. And they said, well, we don't know if we'll offer it again. And I said, I hate to do it, but I'm turning it down. I got a commitment here I'm going to fulfill. So, So it all worked out. Some people flew down, one talked me into staying, but I don't know why, but it turned out good. Probably one of the best leadership things that I did. I had there for a while initially, Steve. I had 42 people assigned to me in an infantry platoon between the ages of 18 and 21 with two or three, you know, senior sergeants. They were, half of them were draftees, three quarters of them were draftees that did not want to be there.
Right.
And so you can imagine the challenges on that. And so I really spent some time and figured out how to get them trained up. So in case we did have to go over there, the probability of getting hurt was less.
Right.
So,
right.
Crazy stories.
When you graduated,
you heard the old stories that I had one guy that had been convicted of a felony out in Western Texas. This is a true story. I said, why are you in the Army here, man? You didn't get drafted. And he said, well, the judge told me the old story, lines that he used. He says, you can go to jail or go in the Army. And so he came in the Army.
Yep.
But, you know, God love him. So that's it. All right. So enough of that. So I'll stop and let you ask me a question.
Well,
so
those are probably
too long of stories for your listeners.
No. This is all about you, brother. It's not about me. But there are some questions because you're being humble. When you graduated FSU, you graduated with honors, didn't you?
Yeah. I was a distinguished military graduate from the ROTC program. And my GPA wasn't all that great because I ended up working last 2 years because I was married. And let's see what I was going to say. That 30 hours a week.
Wow.
Took a full load. But I didn't complain about that. I mean, it always
worked. It was just life.
Yeah,
right.
That's right.
And it's amazing how many law enforcement professionals we bring on the show here that as they're working full-time jobs, they're going to college full-time
same
time.
That's right.
Then you hear people today complaining because it's taken them 6 years to get that 4-year degree.
Yeah, that's true. And we had strict rules in the scholarship house too, so had to comply in certain things you had to do. Interesting.
Yep. Very good.
I did get contacted not a couple of years ago from Florida State, from the criminology department. They saw something that interested them. They called me and said, Dale, we'd like for you to be on the developmental council down there for the criminology board. They have a real, like a top 10 criminology thing board. And I said, well, yeah, okay. In full disclosure here, I need to tell you, I've never taken a criminology course. And that's a true story. And they said, oh, yeah, we know, but you've got a lot of experience, blah, blah, blah. So I enjoy that. I get to go down there once a year and I don't tell them stories. They probably wouldn't appreciate them, but that's it. So it's a good bunch. A lot of smart kids coming through it too. So
for all our listeners, we're recording this in October of 2024. So if you hear this down the road, you'll know when this was recorded. And this year it's like FSU forgot to recruit a football team, didn't they? What the heck's going on up there? I'm shocked.
That's right. That's exactly right. We're all in shock. But I don't think West Virginia is doing too well either, are they?
They're 3-2, I think. But if you remember back, Bobby Bowden coached at West Virginia before.
That's right.
To FSU.
They ran him out of town, though, if I recall.
Well, you know, he wasn't winning.
Had a moving truck pull up in his house.
Well, but then he comes down here to Florida, just kicks butt,
takes names. I know.
Holy cow!
That's it.
Might have had something to do with the recruitment budget. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Exactly. Yep.
So, it's just interesting to hear about how you got in the FBI because it's, you know, I had my first run in with the cops at 10 years old, but I was trying to break in a house. It was a little bit different than yours. But I kind of got interested in that. But
I did some things that probably, I'm with you.
Well, you and I were talking about that thin blue line that you could go one way or another. I was actually on the wrong side there when I was a young kid.
I wouldn't doubt that, I mean, everybody, whatever.
So, I'm sure that you and I had this discussion, but I'd forgotten that your father was a minister because my father was a Southern Baptist minister also. So maybe that's the connection here. I don't know.
There was never any large churches that he
had,
but a lot of good people though. You know something though? I mean, the quality of those folks that I grew up with were just downright good Americans.
Yep.
I mean, there were some bad people mixed in the crowd, but neighbors helping neighbors, and hurricane comes and trees fall down and everybody go out. And, I mean, it was just a community of like-minded people, I guess.
Speaking of hurricanes, Milton's supposed to be here tomorrow afternoon, so.
Yep.
I still wanted to get this in before the power goes out. So in 1978, is that when you went to the academy, the FBI academy?
I graduated in 78, yes. I went there in, I think, January of 78 and graduated out of there like May and went to Birmingham.
So now, back during this time when you went through the academy, and that's in Quantico, right? The FBI
that's
academy
correct.
There in Quantico, Virginia, on the Marine Corps base. A lot of our listeners hear me ask this of a lot of questions, or a lot of our guests here that were former feds. Did you ever have to write any memos while you were in the academy for bonehead acts or things that were looked at as being bonehead acts?
No. But you mean acts by me or acts by other people or what?
No, memos? Like if you did something that they didn't think was right or maybe talk back to somebody. You don't remember that, huh?
No. What was that? Maybe I lost my mind. At the academy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't remember. Okay. I don't have anything. I'm just trying to find out if there is something.
I do not. No, you were all kind of, I went there with the attitude right out of the Army. I'm in excellent physical conditioning and training. And I thought this would be really a hard 8 weeks or 12 weeks, whatever it was. And I learned quickly that that was not the situation with my classmates. Not that I was better than all of them, but you'd been around some of them, and I'm not going to call out any categories here, but some of them had trouble with being told what to do and, have your room thing. I mean, it's a little paramilitary down there.
Yeah.
And if you haven't been in the military, it can be probably upsetting. So I kind of just breeze through. That's not right. It was not a big challenge for me. The only thing challenging was some of the, not even the PT stuff, but there were some tests there, like law tests. We had to take two law exams. The bureau rule was you could only make two tests below the score of 80 on any test or you would get kicked out. So guys would go in and say, oh, yeah, I got this covered, and they get 75 or whoever it was. They're on the edge for every test going forward. So it was kind of stressful. So that sort of thing. And then you try to form up scenarios of bank robberies and all that stuff and form up a team. And quite a few people have not really been like cohesive teams anywhere. They had different backgrounds than myself. So it was fine. It was fine. I enjoyed it. I made lifelong friends. And
nice.
We lost a couple of people for, I think, injuries, and one for academic. One, some other stories, but that's it.
Imagine where those are, but we're not going there.
I was on that. So.
So when you were going through the academy, did you, like when I went through in 87 and we were there at the FBI Academy, we filled out what we called a wish list, where the offices we would like to be assigned to, but then they sent you where they wanted to. Did you get to do a wish list?
Yeah, I did. I got to choose three places, and this is a good point. In my employment letter, the letter very specifically said, you'll be assigned to places that has the needs of the Bureau. And this comes into play later on in my career. I said, well, I have needs. I'd like to go to Jacksonville, Tampa, or Miami. And that
and they sent you too.
That didn't match up their needs. They said, "Well, you're needed in Birmingham." And I said, "Holy smokes, are you serious? You know, that's a steel mining company and blah blah blah." I was assigned to Birmingham, and I went there, and first office agent, as you well know, is to be seen and not heard. And I worked some applicant work and some white collar crime and civil rights cases there for about 3 or 4 months. New SAC comes in and he looks around and he says, you've been doing this long enough. He said, with your military experience, you can work by yourself. So I got assigned 3 rural counties around Birmingham. Mm-hmm. And I was the FBI for that, those 3 counties. And it was a wild time, but I tell you what, it's one of the best times I had. You know, I mean, life-threatening situations, I don't talk about them, but, you know, you had those. You had stuff that you did that was just absolutely that the parents still call today or send me a Christmas card or something. Around,
nice.
Believe it or not.
Very nice.
Who's left. And learned a lot. Learned all about the criminal investigative world and Department of Justice and what's a grand jury and what's a, how do you do a search warrant? How do you do a wiretap? How do you do, you know, multi-rate, you know, blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, it was a good experience. And they all, I tell this story very seldom, but this one is, I went there and that's what I was doing. And for 3 counties, and I stayed out of the office. I didn't know any of the office gossip. I wasn't involved in that. I'd go in the mornings and pick up my stuff, and they let me take a car home because I left from home sometimes to go to work. And so I was there. They wanted me to join the SWAT team, so I joined the SWAT team. But there were cases that came up. In one case, a girl ran away, and the sheriff, rural county, you know, he's up for reelection, and he calls me up and says, she's been kidnapped. And I said, well, the facts were, it looks to me like it's a runaway. And he says, well, you got to help me. This family's longtime members here in the county. I said, I'll help you, but we have to have either a note or some source that says they've left the state or whatever to get involved here. And okay. So he left it at that. And mysteriously, the next day, he had a source that said they thought that she'd left and gone, been kidnapped and taken up to Tennessee or something, the state above. And he said, I want you to, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I opened a case on it, worked it really, and she left from a truck stop. And long story short, 3 or 4 days later, he calls and says, she's back. And I said, really? 16-year-old girl. He says, yeah, she showed up where left the car. And so, he had her picked up and they went to the house and he said, Del, we can't get her to say anything. Can you help us? Can you interview her? And so I said, well, I'll come over and sit in. So I went over there on the couch. The point of the story is I drive up in Ford LTD, 4-wheel, black wall tires, antennas. They got 5 guns on me and AR-15. I mean, a bunch of stuff. And I get out with my almost leather briefcase that the Bureau gave me. And walk in. I'm doing an interview with these people. Well,
almost leather.
I knew I was kind of in trouble here when I drove up. There were like 4 or 5 cars, and one was the local radio station that put out about 5,000 watts, so it didn't go anywhere hardly.
Yeah,
and I'm walking through the gate to get into the porch to walk into this farmhouse, and as I'm walking along, I hear on my right side this reporter for the radio station. I didn't know her. Didn't even know they had a reporter. And she says, and now we just learned that the FBI has entered the case. And I'm here to tell you, Steve, I actually stopped. I was a young age at probably 6 months in. I actually stopped and I thought, well, where are they? I did look around and I said, FBI. And then I realized, that's me. I am the FBI for this. Like, oh, the Savior's come to save us or something. Huh? Something like that. I didn't take it to that extreme. But so I go in there and the sheriff's there, the chief deputy there is she was an adopted child, 16, and they were very elderly. So you kind of get the scene what's going on. So I'm just listening, and she says, No, I don't know. I said, just excuse me, Sheriff. You know, would all of you step out of the room? I want to talk to her. And so very nice. I always tried to treat people as nice as I could, as if the roles were reversed. So I talked to her and I said, look, you're going to get in serious trouble here if you lie to me, and this is going to get really worse. You need to come clean and what happened. And she says, yes, I wrote up down. Nobody got good guy and picked me up and brought me back, and they'd taken her to the hospital. So none of that was involved, thank goodness. And so, and she started crying. And so I don't know why I'm telling you all this, but the bottom line was, she said, will you tell my parents? And I said, nope. You're going to tell them in front of me, in front of the sheriff, in front of the chief deputy. We wasted a lot of time and effort here to get you to admit what you did. And so she came out, blah, blah, blah. They all started trying, except the sheriff. And he was happy he's going to be able to say he solved the case, and which was fine with me. So we got out of that. But the representation that I was the FBI, just, I mean, it was seared in my brain from going on. You are the FBI. And I'd go around those places, and they'd call in from one town to the next. If they saw me coming, they didn't know I had their frequencies. And so they'd say, yeah, the FBI's headed your way. Be sharp down there or something. I mean, they'd pass the word.
I was alive.
Get out of the coffee shop quick or something. Yeah, or something like that. But it made a lasting impact upon who I was.
Yeah.
And I knew that it was unbelievable, and good times, bad times.
And lifelong friends.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And just good people. But there were several bad people too. So you had to watch yourself. Okay.
So after 4 years, I think, in Birmingham, you got notification that your time in the South was up, huh?
Yep. The deeds of the Bureau decided they needed me to go after working criminal cases. And they were fun to work and chasing fugitives, and probably every one of them coming close to every violation that the FBI had, like horse thieves and Mann Act.
Yeah.
And I mean, just every kind of thing, and theft from interstate shipment. Yep. It was a policy. And so they needed me to go to New York City. I said, well,
you know, when I heard that, I'm thinking that old show. I was thinking that old TV show, McCloud.
Yeah.
When he goes to New York.
Yeah. So you can imagine, I went up there. I think it was the time that interest on houses were 18%, back 15 to 18%. I think it was when Jimmy Carter had the inflation problem, and my house payments doubled, and car insurance went up. I had to live in Jersey, and I lived outside of Manhattan. I had to go to Manhattan every morning and get stuff and do it. But I got assigned to Foreign Counterintelligence.
And now, that's completely different than what you were doing, right?
Yeah, and that other stuff was all Title 18 stuff and some other title authorities. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I first heard the term Title 50. And Title 50 was the governing rules, basically, and violations of basically spy work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got put on a squad of looking at some Eastern European countries because the wall was still up. And every country in the world has people that come signed to the United Nations. Every country in the world has individuals that have an intelligence service. And so the responsibilities were, you got these people assigned to you, and you're responsible for them. And no one else had responsibility. And so it was kind of a daunting thing. I quickly realized the people I was going up against were very smart, and people made fun of some of them, but their intelligence agents were very good. And they spoke about three different languages. And a criminal, you could always, if you couldn't solve a bank robbery, if some guy robbing the bank every Thursday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, then you were in the wrong business. I mean, they were They were pretty simple, easy cases. These cases turned into cat and mouse game. And I don't want to embellish this at all, and I don't want to give away any secrets, but you literally had to think two moves ahead. If you thought that you go to Dairy Queen every Thursday night, well, I'll see him at Thursday night. You know, you got to think that he's going to drive by the Dairy Queen, or not, they don't have Dairy Queens up northern or in New York that I know of.
That's a southern thing.
Yeah, and you drive around. Yeah. So it was challenging. It was very, very challenging. And I can't talk about it, but we did some really excellent work. I remember, though, the difference, though. I remember you went out to 120th Avenue in Flatbush out in Brooklyn, and I was going to interview this guy for one of my cases, and those cases were never closed. I mean, you see the guy buy in, he's here for 4 years or 3 years, and then if he flies out, he hasn't been able to do any harm to our country. You consider that a success. And so always thought that there were people that would work for them that were American citizens that we definitely needed to stop. So I was early on in this thing. And so I went out to Brooklyn one morning, and pretty early I drove out there, and it's just a local, you know, row house or whatever it was. I knocked on this guy's door, and I said, I'm with the FBI. I need to talk to you for a minute. He says, where are you from? Because of my accent.
Yeah.
And then it took me 5 seconds to translate his question to me. And I said, well, where are you from? And he goes, no. He said, you're not from here, are you? And I said, no, I'm not from here. Where are you from? He said, well, I grew up here in Brooklyn. I said, well, I'm from L.A. He looks at me. He's wearing the old skivvy shirt, the white skivvy shirt. He's got the big gut and everything. And he goes, huh? I said, yeah, Lower Alabama.
That's right.
He started laughing. And believe me, the ice was broken with this guy. So it pretty good. So
that's but it sense was, of humor it will get different. You a long way.
Yeah, that's right. Hoagies and calzones and pizza. They did have good pizza. But I could leave at 6 o'clock in the morning. I needed to be in there by 6:45 or 7. First time I tried that, 7:30 traffic. I had to go through the tunnel. And then any increments of 10 minutes after 6 o'clock, man, it added like 20 minutes to your commute. So,
what a nightmare. Yeah. What a change, too. What a drastic change from Birmingham.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you did, I think you did 3 years there in New York, and then they dragged you into Washington.
Yep, they did. And I was kind of glad they needed me in Washington. I'd gotten tired of New Jersey life. I lived in a small town in New Jersey off the Garden State Parkway, and I wasn't familiar with protocols and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And the guys that picked up my trash, it came Christmas time, and I guess I didn't tip them or something. And then right after Christmas, every time they picked up my trash, it ended up in the front yard. So I finally told the driver, he said, well, you got to give us a little something on the holiday.
A little love.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Oh, gosh. So,
that's the union.
But riding the subway, first time I got on that thing, going up to Midtown to go by one of the establishments up there, I said, golly, this is crowded. It's really packed. It's hot in here. And it pulls out of the station, goes about 150 yards, and the lights go out. And that was my first experience in there. I'm thinking, holy gosh, this is unbelievable. So,
where am I?
And they're funny, funny subway stories. Tourists were the worst. I mean, in the summer, this young woman was riding the subway, and it's not the best place to be pulling out a map. Like, I don't know where I'm at or what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. So she was looking around. She rode down to the city hall where I got off, and I got to her and I said, how long you been in New York? So I just got here. And I said, well, do yourself a favor. Look where you want to go before you get on the train, because people see that stuff and they'll follow you around, steal your purse. And I saw people steal purses, and it wasn't very good.
Yep. Look at you, Southern boy, up there teaching people how to live in New York City.
I guess so. I don't know.
New York City.
And coming back from working a real late surveillance one night up in uptown, way up in Manhattan. And I parked my bureau car in the garage way downtown, down by the World Trade Center. Get on the advice was when you went up there, stay off the first train and last train. That's kind of where the trouble is. So it was late. It was like 2 o'clock. I knew I wouldn't get home till 4 o'clock or something by riding the train. So I jumped on the train and the last car was pulling out when I got to the station. And I jumped in it, sat down, and I looked, and there were only two people on it, me and another guy, and he was sitting catty corner toward the back. The doors close. He reaches in his pocket. He has a switchblade. He still, starts flicking the switchblade and looking at me. And I'm thinking, I'm tired. I don't want to have to shoot this guy.
Yeah.
I just don't want to do it. All the paperwork, and I'm exhausted. And so I decided at the time when we carried handkerchiefs, I got out of my handkerchief and got my gun out and started rubbing my gun down.
There you go.
And looking at him. And then it stops at the next stop. Man, he couldn't get off that train fast.
That's when he realized he brought a knife to a gunfight.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So there were all kind of stories. So I don't want to waste time.
Oh, my goodness. Now, I was going to say, why did they bring you into Washington out of New York City then?
Success working up there.
And they wanted you to continue the counterterrorism.
No, this is not counterterrorism. It's strictly counterintelligence.
Okay, gotcha.
The terrorism program in our building was bombed, I think, once while I was up there. But there wasn't a big program around terrorism for the Bureau. Very, very small, as a matter of fact. And so the counterterrorism people wanted me to come down there. And then I shifted and started looking and helping, the main offices that had counterterrorism or counterintelligence programs. So as a grade 14. So if that helps.
Did you know, when you got to Washington, did you by any chance you ever run into another agent named Peter Lapp? Pete Lapp?
No, I don't think so.
He did the case on Ana Montes, who was working for Castro out of Cuba.
Oh, yeah. State Department. Getting involved in the State Department, too, right?
I think she was DIA, Defense Intelligence.
Probably. I don't know that case. Okay. I don't know when it was or what happened. But it's very interesting because you'd try to do a surveillance up there, and I don't know if it's still in place or not, but they'd drive around the east side and cut through the parking garage of the UN building, and we were not allowed to go in the UN building. And they wouldn't even stop. They'd just come and get back on the loose surveillance. So you always had to account for that. It was kind of crazy. We weren't welcome up there.
Yeah.
So,
but in Washington, so you're doing the same thing. You're still doing working on the spies up there.
Yeah, but I'm at a headquarters assignment. I'm not out doing them.
Oh,
looking at it. I'm getting Title 50 authorities for them and tracking, see where they're good, what they need help with. So it's kind of a caseload. I had parts of the country.
Would that be? I guess maybe sure what we would call a staff coordinator position, or were you promoted?
I was promoted. I was grade 13, and I got promoted to 14 to go down there. And I stayed there, and it's never a place to go where you want to stay, or me anyway. So generally the rule of thumb is to stay 2 or 3 years there, and you can go out back out to the field. That was what happened.
But while you're in headquarters, you end up being in headquarters, what, like, looks like 9 years?
No, I was only there 2.5 on that assignment before I was selected. I volunteered, probably the last, no, there's not the last job I volunteered for, to be run a squad, a counterintelligence squad over at Washington Field Office. And so that's a well sought out position because I didn't have to move my family or any of that stuff. But there were like 30 people, but I put in, I got it. So I stayed there for like 4 years, and we did a lot of good stuff on that. We PNG'd some people, and I mean, it was fascinating. I don't know if I can tell you this story or not, but
If you're not comfortable, don't tell us.
No, we were trying to recruit somebody.
We might be getting into means and methods there. We don't want to do anything like that.
Yeah.
All right, so you do that, and then so what's your next step after doing that squat?
Well, an interesting thing happened. Very interesting thing. The wall fell down. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, these Germans were our friends. We went over and got all the intel files they had on Americans or whatever. I mean, we had to clean that up, and that was a lot of work. But all the most of the dangerous countries that we were worried about were turned into be allies, like the Czechs, the Poles. I mean, East Germany turned into Germany. The need for that was no longer needed. It was needed, but there wasn't very good work, so to speak. So yeah. I got a call from the deputy director who said, Dell, he said, we got this terrorism problem coming. He said, we want you to come back and go into terrorism and take over a unit that's responsible for Iran and Hezbollah and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I said, yeah, I want to do that because it blends criminal with Title 50 authority. And he said, you've got all the skills we need. You're really one of a few that have really been cross-trained and have success in whatever you're doing. I said my success was triggered by a lot of good people and a lot of hard work, but, you know, a lot of luck. I went over there and was putting that unit, and it was unbelievable. I mean, that was just the start of the terrorism stuff, World Trade Center and stuff like that. Did that for, I don't know, three or four years. It was after the first World Trade Center. That's when I was ordered to go to Kansas City. And that was 1994. I was there from 82 to 94. That doesn't sound right. It was about 3 years, I think. And that was my second tour there. So I was picked up as a grade 15 at that point.
And so it looks on my notes, I've got you went to Kansas City in 94. So I think you're right there.
Okay. Yeah, my memory should.
So if you're one of the experts that they brought in, handpicked to lead this unit that's focused on Iran and all their terroristic activities, why would they pull you out and send you to Kansas City?
Because I begged them.
Oh, okay. Well, you said you were ordered. I thought they made you go.
Yeah. No. I wanted to be an SAC out in the field office. That was almost like an eighth grade. I mean, that was one of my things. I thought the best work was out in the field or wherever it was. And I'm not a headquarters guy. I used headquarters to try to get where I wanted to go. I put in for it, and there were three openings. This is the last time I think I had to put in for a job. There were three openings. One was Salt Lake City, one was Kansas City, and one was Richmond. Well, I was living here, and I said, I'd like to go to Richmond. I could almost commute that, and et cetera, et cetera. They said, well, you know, blah, 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 blah. And so it turned out that I was slotted to go to Salt Lake City, and they swapped. And I don't mean this derogatory. They had an older gentleman, good guy. I worked for him for a while, who was out in Kansas City, was going to retire. So they wanted somebody to come in there and juice that thing. So,
change things around a little bit.
Yeah. And it turned from small office in Birmingham to the largest field office, to headquarters, to the second largest field office, WFO, to Kansas City, which was a medium-sized office, which was really good, I had all the whole state of Kansas and the whole state of Missouri, three quarters of the state of Missouri jurisdiction. And I had all the criminal programs, didn't have the intelligence program because it was so small.
Yeah. And then you weren't there. Were you there a year before something significant happened in 1995?
I think I got to stay 2 years or 18 months or something, though. But what got me out of there was Oklahoma City.
And we're talking about the bomb.
I did, the Oklahoma City behind me. But before that, before I went out to Kansas City, the National Academy, Steve, you've heard of that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. the National Academy was a big thing for these offices, particularly Birmingham and Kansas City. I don't think, probably New York too. But for your audience, it's a training program that the Bureau does for sergeants and above in local law enforcement. They treat mm-hmm. them better than the Aegis, that they bring them back. And it's very selective and it's hard to get in. And that they have an alumni association that was really absolutely beneficial. It worked very, very well. They have meetings and national convention meetings. And if you ever met anybody from NA, they've never said a bad word about being there or the organization. Yeah. So I decided, I was under orders for Kansas City, and I decided to look in the see who's at the National Academy, and one of their captains from Kansas City, Kansas, was there. So I went down to visit him and see him. And he says, yeah, Dale, welcome. I'll help, blah, blah, blah. Just to have somebody that mm-hmm. said you knew. And so he said, we really enjoy it. I just wish we could get more slots for the people for law enforcement in Kansas. And so I thought about that. I said, And I looked at the roster and there were, I think, 200 in a class, but there was a pretty good plug of foreign officers. And so
the bashful person you are.
Yeah. Being proactively thinking, I said, what's wrong with this? I only get two slots every time the NA comes out, in the ASAC job or out in Kansas City, ultimately the SEC decides. So I went back and I knew the director very well. I said, director, we all lay off of this. This is like supporting the home team here. And he said, Dell, he said, nope. He said, we're going to put as many in there as we can around the terrorism problem. And I said, that stinks. So fast forward to the embassy bombings. This is a true story. Embassy bombings come up, and it's a terrible thing. Two embassies blown up in Africa, and we're trying to figure. We don't have a LEAD anywhere in sight. I think the closest one was South Africa, or maybe it might have been Greece or Rome. And so I said, I stopped for a minute, walking up the stairs to get some stuff so we can kind of get this thing coordinated. And I stopped for a second and said, I'm going to get that NA book and see if there's one law enforcement guy in either place here that can help us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I opened up the book, and sure enough, there was a sergeant in Kenya that was in the city there, Nairobi. I didn't know him. He was just a sergeant listed. He graduated like 2 years earlier. And so I said, this is worth a shot. And in order to go to the National Academy, they had to speak English. I got my operations officer people to call. He got on the phone, and I said, you don't know me. I'm with the FBI and assistant director. He said, forgotten my title at the time. I said, we have a lot of people headed your way. We really don't know who to trust and where to go, and could you meet my guy? Give him some help. He says, well, I'll absolutely, Mr. Watson, you send him to me. And we learned a lot about who could trust and who he thought were corrupt and that. And I hung up the phone and I said, we need more foreign people going to NA. I went from keep these people out to get these people in there. I mean, it was unbelievable.
NA program, that's the best program the Bureau's got going. I wish we had something like that. Yeah. We tried the Drug Unit Commander Academy, Duke of Classes, and that's just, in fact, they now have a, I don't know if you know this, Dale, but they bring Javier and I to speak to all the DEA cadet classes going through now.
Oh, yeah.
So we go to Academy a couple times a year, and we met the DEA agent assigned to training that's detailed over to the FBI's National Academy. So they're doing four of those classes a year now.
Oh, good.
That's good. And they're actually putting feds in there now. There's some DEA guys that actually go through the National Academy, but it's the best program I've ever seen, man.
Yeah, and that was J. Edgar Hoover whatever you think about him, but he created that. But he did have to caveat. He said, if you go to NA, I won't recruit these guys to be FBI agents.
Will not, right?
So, will not. Will, yeah, and especially from smaller departments, you mm-hmm. know, you send your best and brightest to this thing, and it's a long waiting list and blah, blah, blah. And then they come back and say, oh, yeah, I'm taking a job with you. I mean, you wouldn't get any more candidates.
Right,
so,
right.
And
makes perfect sense.
I think that's spent a little bit waived, but I don't know that for sure. So,
yeah.
But it's amazing how you can change your mind.
Oh, yeah. Well, it kind of depends on where you sit.
Out of here. Yeah, that's it. That's exactly right. And your needs.
Yeah.
It's like the old needed letter. I didn't need a letter to tell me that I should go here or there. So,
yeah.
That was good. I was out in Kansas City. Are we in Kansas City in this story?
Yeah, we're hitting on the Oklahoma. We're good, man. We're going to take a break here in a few minutes, okay. But I want to talk a little bit about the Oklahoma City bombing first.
Okay.
What was your involvement? You're the ASAC out there, right?
I'm the criminal ASAC, yes. And
are you in Oklahoma City?
No. I'm in Kansas City. Okay.
Okay.
And it's morning, and the secretary comes in and says there's been an explosion in Kansas, or in Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. And turned on, it's all good things. We turned on the television, and, you know, you could see it was massive. I thought my initial reaction was, and I said a silent prayer, I said, please let this be a gas explosion. You know, mm-hmm. you have to have something. Let this be gas. It wasn't long before the plate or the part of the car, the van that he had, the truck that he took down there. The VIN number was discovered. And guess what? That truck was rented in western Kansas, out mm-hmm. in Fort Riley, Kansas. And so that immediately triggered headquarters calling and saying, what do you got out there? And well, we don't have anything. I have one guy that does it on a road trip. And so I made a conscious decision at that time to just say, okay. And then the phone rings and my friend who's ASAC down in Oklahoma City says, Dale, can you send me your evidence response team? I said, well, sure, they'll be on the road in an hour. So we drained off that resource and then started headed out to getting people to Junction City to try to collect the data there. And it was a challenging time. I saw that the Bureau responds in crisis very well. You get what you want, all the resources you need. But when the light goes on, you need to do something. You know, can't be wishy-washy about it.
Right.
In a day or two, maybe it was after McVeigh was picked up and arrested, headed back to Fort Riley where he was. We went out and had discovered that the car was rented out there and that I've forgotten exactly. We had Nichols under surveillance, and I don't remember exactly how we got to him. It was through, I can't remember, but he popped up as a secondary subject.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that this was a big deal. We went from like two agents out there to like 100 agents to like 50 support people. We brought in ATF, went to the Army and said, we need a place to work out of. And they gave us one of their buildings, and it was come and go. I learned a lot about crisis. You have to break those things down into pieces. And somebody's got to look for this. Somebody's got to do this. Somebody's searching this. And so we went out there and just worked the devil out of it for 67 days. We arrested Nichols the night, ran a search warrant on his house, discovered there were just unbelievable things that tied him and McVeigh together. We knew exactly. I can tell you some of those details if you want to know them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And some of it was luck. Some of it was hard work. And so, first of all, he picked McVeigh up when he rented the truck. We couldn't figure out exactly who. There was an unsub there for a long time, and it turned out to be his son, Nichols, saw it. They went and stopped at McDonald's, and we didn't know that. We didn't know anything. We collected all that data. It's the early age. We couldn't quite figure out how that there were pieces to the puzzle we couldn't figure out. Where did they get the debt cord? And I'm on the call every morning at 6:30 with the Director Free and the Attorney General and a bunch of other strap hangers, or not strap hangers, but a lot of people on those calls and tied in with Oklahoma City and telling them what we were doing. And so there's a lot of pressure around, where did he get the accelerant to set this thing off? And so we had worked and worked on the ammonia nitrate. We went to every farm supply company in Kansas before we hit a home run on that one. So I figured, well, this has got to be solved. That, you know, that's a key point here. And we knew they parked it down in the state park. But to get to the accelerant, I said, okay, that's enough. We're going to go to every sheriff, every police department in Kansas. And so I put 12 agents and 12, I think there were 12 ATF agents on it. And I said, you start here, make a circle. You go to every police, every sheriff's department in the state to see if they've had some debt cord stolen or what and whatever it was. And I thought the probability of that was probably about 10%. They started out, they'd come back every night. How far are you out? 50 miles. Have you got anything? Nothing. You know, it kept going. And then later on, they were about 150 miles away from Junction City. The supervisor comes back in and says, Dale, I think we got something. I said, what do you have? And he said, the sheriff down there in the strip mine was stolen in September. Now we're in May of the year of the bombing. And he said, yeah, there's some explosive cord stolen. And I said, okay. I said, all right, let's figure this out. They were smart. I didn't have to tell him a whole lot. He said the sheriff has some stuff, and he swears it's some locals that went into the strip mine and stolen the stuff. And he said, I need some more agents. I said, okay, you take three or four more and go back down there and see if he has any evidence. So he comes back with a lot. And the way they got into it, it was a ground, I don't know, concave, convex, whatever it is. And they had to lay on their back. It's out in the middle of nowhere. And they drilled the lock to get in there. Got the lock. We got the lock. And we were all in the meeting at 6 o'clock before one of the phone calls one day. And the guy that comes back in says, here's the lock. It had to be drilled. And we were in Nichols's house like 2 days, 3 days after, we were down in the basement, and one of my supervisors saw a handheld drill. And so he said, it's for what it's worth. So we got a search warrant, went back, got that handheld drill, sent that lock, that handheld drill to the lab. Shavings out of that bit was in that lock.
You are kidding.
No, 150 miles away.
Wow.
I mean, that's just one example. The other example is they mixed it down at Gary State Lake. We didn't know that. And that's a lake about 20 miles south of Farrington or Fort Riley. And so we couldn't figure that one out either. You know, I mean, where in the world? So one of my agents was eating breakfast one morning at McDonald's, and we took over the city, basically. The sheriff. The chief of police was an NA guy, and you couldn't drive anywhere without seeing four-door black wall-tired bureau cars driving around. Yep. They were staying there. They were working and not come back at night or something. And this older gentleman comes up to him and says, are you with the FBI? And he says, well, yes, sir, I am. He says, I saw a rental truck down at Gary State Lake parked, and it was like the day before the bombing. And I saw a car parked next to it. And so the agent said, can you take me down there? And so he took the agent down there. And around there were burn sites where, like, diesel, you know, the high smell of diesel fuel, you know, probably been parked and mixed. So we took that, and I got a evidence response team to come down from Omaha to go search that ground, and they found traces of the material of the back seat of McVeigh's car on the ground there, mixed in that diesel.
I mean, You know what? Some people may say that's chance, that that's luck. There's no such thing. There's no such thing as coincidence. That's good investigative work. You get fortunate at times.
Yeah,
I'm not calling
luck.
It luck.
Some luck. Yeah. Well, it's hard work. But I used to get accused of that. They'd say, you're the luckiest guy on the planet. And I said, you know something? The harder I work, the luckier I got.
That's kind of correlated there.
One other lucky deal was we decided to grab, on the day of the rental truck, we decided to grab all the video cameras of businesses and there weren't many back then, of and if people come in there that, you know, McVeigh or Nichols, particularly around fast food. And at McDonald's, they had cameras up. And the one camera we really needed, it wasn't working. But there was one pointed outside, and we saw Nichols and his son pass by there. And about 5 minutes later, we saw McVeigh's car come in and park. So we knew we put them all together. And, yeah. But a funny story, a sideline from this, I love for an NA. I immediately, when I got to town, went and talked to the NA graduate who was the chief of this pretty good, probably 20 officers or something. I said, Chief, we're here. You're welcome to come out. I'll show you just hospitality. And he said, well, and I wanted to keep in touch with him in case any of our employees or agents did something stupid or, deal. It's called internal affairs. I wanted to keep all of that headed off or discipline or something. I don't know.
Yep.
So he said, okay, fine. So everything's fine. I'd see him about once a month. I was out there until July. And then he calls me in late June, or he didn't call me. He left a message, said, I need to see him 8 o'clock next morning. I'm thinking, gosh, what did we do? Did we use one of his officers or his officers try to arrest one of our guys? I'm just thinking the horror story. And so I go in there, and he's got coffee and donut. And he says, hey, how you doing there? And he said, Dale, don't take this the wrong way. He says, when are you guys getting out of town? And I said, well, we're about wrapped up here. We'll probably be another week or so. I said, have we done something wrong? And he said, oh, no. He said, the only problem is I had a budget meeting with city council. And if you don't leave, I'm going to lose two officers out of the budget because we haven't had an armed robbery, burglary, bank robbery or anything. He said, you guys are just taking over the town. He said, we're appreciative of the lower crime rate, but get out or I'm going to defund too. Absolutely a true story. You have to have a few senses of humor in there. So
absolutely. That's small town right there.
That is. That's it. And I'd bring in the locals. We had the old barracks, barbed wire, the Army provided MPs, that sort of stuff. And it was really an interesting time. Once again, on the crisis side, you can't walk into there and be a rookie. I mean, that was alive. We had to send people home that were
not living up to their expectations.
It's just, I tried. What I did, though, one of the things I did, I think was pretty good. Every night at 6:30, we would meet the whole workforce. I don't care if you were answering the phones or whatever. And we would go over where we were and what we did. Or not accomplished, and that kept everybody. They felt like they were part of the program and
keeps everybody motivated.
The problem was stuff started leaking, and we sent teletypes to different field offices, and they'd leak story about the explosives found in that county. I mean, they said, "Well, you leaked it." I said, "Well, bring the polygraph in here. We'll polygraph every one of my guys and." I know we pass. They don't have time to leak it, and there's nobody here to leak it. That went on, and that was a decent. It was an interesting time. I think I stayed 65 days or something straight.
Jeez.
And there's nothing like eating church's fried chicken at 11:30 at night.
Oh, does it?
That's what the supervisor said. Let's blue light it down to, I think it was church's. That's a chain out there.
Oh, yeah.
It's like 10 o'clock. We've been at it since 6 a.m. or whatever. And just to know that we'll be back there at 6 a.m. But it's a camaraderie of that. And people talk about it. Everybody has stories just like 9/11.
Hey, players, that's the end of part one. Part two comes out, as always, on Tuesday. In the meantime, just a reminder that Game of Crimes is now posting interview videos on YouTube. You can find those at Game of Crimes Podcast. Our website is gameofcrimespodcast.com, where you'll find all our episodes, our guests, book lists, merchandise, and more. And for more content, join us on patreon.com/gameofcrimes. I have several monthly episodes that range from silly to serious, so come on over and join the fun. In the meantime, everyone stay safe. I'll see you tomorrow for part two.